Welcome back. Good to have you back tonight, and we're going to continue our study of the medieval church, which, as you recall, is from roughly 470 to about 1517, the end of the ancient Roman Empire to the beginning of the Reformation. And what we're doing is we're working our way through chronologically through this time frame. And I say chronologically, in the sense that we're going to be sort of moving in general in this direction. But we are, you can't help but do a little bobbing and weaving, because some of the things we're going to talk about are going to extend from early in the medieval church into later periods, and then there'll be other things we'll have to step back to, and it'll go back to here, and it'll go. So there's layers of this, and so we're not going to be looking at, you know, events like this. We're going to be looking at events more like this and slowly moving our way into the future. It's one of the side effects of the medieval church and how things work. Now, let's refresh our memory. You remember that on the western side of the empire, or the former empire, the church there is working to bring order to chaos. The barbarians have come, and Rome has fallen, and so the church over there rises up to fill the gap, to fill in the chaos, all right, working to bring order. It's also working to convert the barbarians that have come south, either to initial faith in Christ or to Nicene Orthodoxy, because you remember many of them coming down from the north were Arians, and so the church is working to convert them to a Nicene view of Trinitarian theology. And then it's also, of course, working to establish itself, or I should say it's going through the process of establishing itself as a political force. Particularly, we find the church coming down to a single bishop that is leading the church, and his bishops below him are answering to him and so forth. And so we see it becoming more of a political force in the West than it is in the East. Because you remember, in the East, you still have an actual emperor. You still have an actual empire. The church is secondary to that empire. The church is not considered to be the leadership of the nation, the political nation. I'm sure the bishops and the patriarchs on that side had influence, of course, over the emperors on that side. But you don't see that kind of sense in the East where the church will become the state. That doesn't ever happen on the eastern side of the equation, but it does on the west, all right? So we're seeing this, and the church will then continue in the east, but it will have its own struggles, particularly some theological struggles. Now, these theological struggles in the east will affect, to some degree, the west. There will be some sense in which the west will be involved in these various debates. You will notice that the term that I've been using is an ecumenical council. The word ecumenical meaning across the spectrum, meaning involving all. So the council at Nicaea in 325, the council in Constantinople in 381 were ecumenical councils, the first two ecumenical councils of the church. So it was calling together the totality of the church. And so the councils we're going to see into the future are also ecumenical. There will be those coming from the West. But the West will have less influence over what takes place in these councils. Okay? You will see that the East will be where the real debates will be occurring and where the real decisions will be made. You remember Nicaea and Constantinople were fundamentally Eastern councils. The West was involved, but not to the sense of really having much input. And the same is going to continue in the debates that we're going to be looking at tonight. Now, I had a choice as I got to this point as to what I wanted to talk about next, because there are two things that will come together simultaneously here. One is, of course, the Christological debates that rise in the East, having to do with the nature of Jesus. And then at the same time, as we roll into the 7th century, we'll see the beginnings of Islam. And Muhammad having his visions and developing the Quran and the effect that Islam will have upon the world, and particularly upon the West. So I had a debate between those two things. And when I first did this series several years ago, I put the Arab conquest before the Christological debates. But I decided to reverse that this time because I think The Christological debates connects a bit to the Nicene debates that we had earlier, and so it's much more fresh in your mind. We'll then move to the issue of Islam as a separate issue entirely as we complete this idea of the various theological squabbles that will be taking place. So the rise of the church will affect, the rise of Islam will affect the Eastern Church in the 7th century, but we need to look first at some of the earlier issues that are faced and how the two branches of Christendom begin to separate from one another. All right, so let's talk about the Christological debates, and then when we're done with that, we'll come back to some ecclesiastical divides. Now, you remember that I said a minute ago that the divinity of Jesus had been settled at Nicaea and Constantinople. The Nicene orthodoxy was that Jesus was the Son of God who was fully divine, carrying the fullness of Yahweh in himself, yet distinct as a person from the other two persons of the Trinity. So at Nicaea and Constantinople, you have the divinity issue settled. And as I pointed out also a minute ago, the Arianism that was coming down from the Germanic invaders was being converted into this Nicene Orthodoxy. The idea that Jesus was a separate created being by the Father and divinized when he came to earth was eventually converted to this view of Trinitarianism that we appreciate in Orthodoxy today. Okay, so that issue, the Trinitarian issue, is being taken care of. But now we see a new debate arise. And the next logical debate that would come would be, of course, what is the nature of Jesus? Okay, because we've dealt with the issue of who is the Son. Now we need to deal with who is Jesus. Now you might think those are the same thing, but they're not. Because the first discussion was, who is the Son of God in the Trinity? The second is, who is this man walking around in Judea in the first century and was crucified on a cross? Okay, so those are the two issues. They're separated. And so what we're going to be talking about tonight is a debate over the nature of Jesus as God and man, because that debate rose during this particular period of time. Who is this Jesus? All right. Now, everybody in the discussion agrees that from the perspective of God, that the divine nature of the Son of God is immutable and eternal. Immutable meaning unchanging or unchangeable by outside forces. God is immutable in that he does not change, and he cannot be changed by forces outside of himself. That's immutability. He is an unchanging God whose nature is such that he does not learn, because learning implies change. He knows all things because he is God. He is immutable in nature. His decree is set. It cannot be altered. His nature as God cannot be altered by circumstances. Okay? He is immutable. But he is also eternal. He has always been. God has always existed. From our perspective in time, God has always existed. From outside of time, God has always been. God describing himself as the I am simply reflects the fact that he says, look, no matter where you are, when you are, I am. From your perspective as a timed creature, that's based on, you know, particular dates on a calendar. From my perspective as God, he says, I simply am. Okay, so everybody in the discussion agreed, because of Nicaea and Constantinople, that God is immutable and eternal. The whole church, church-wide, okay? The issue, there was probably a few voices that would, you know, go away. But, I mean, generally speaking, the church held to the view that God is immutable and eternal. But how could, and this naturally becomes the question, then how could the immutable and the eternal be joined with that which is changeable and temporal? Or probably the better word is historical. Now, how can the eternal God that has always existed now join himself with a creature who didn't exist prior to his conception in his mother's womb? And how can an immutable God, one who cannot change, join himself with a creature who does, by definition? Okay? That's the question. And that produces a real tension of how to understand who Jesus is, okay? And so there were two basic sides that were taken in this, and they're based on two different locations: Alexandria in Egypt and Antioch Antioch north of Jerusalem. The Alexandrine position, or those taken by those at Egypt, was that Jesus was a teacher of divine truth, thus his divinity must be asserted, even at the expense of his humanity. So the Alexandrine position focused primarily on the divinity of Jesus. He must be God. The Jesus that was walking around in Jerusalem and was crucified on a cross was God. And so the Alexandrine position had a tendency to focus almost exclusively on the divinity of Christ. The writings of the Alexandrians focus on the divinity of Christ. The Antiochians, however, the Antiochene position, was that Jesus had to be fully human in order to save humans. So their perspective was, well, we need to focus on Jesus as a man, because in order to save us, he must be a man. Thus, his humanity must be asserted, even at the expense of his divinity. So that school took the opposite approach. It's, well, we need to focus on Jesus as a man, because he needed to be a man in order for him to come and save us. Okay, so you have two groups who come to the ring to box this out, and they both go to their separate corners. Okay? So they're both taking a position which is focused on one particular aspect. Now, I suppose you could ask someone in the Alexandrian school, well, do you think that Jesus was human? They would say, well, yeah, but that's not really the important focus. And the same with the other side. Do you think that Jesus is divine? Well, yeah, but that's not really the important focus. So the division of these two places and the various writings and schools of thought and teaching and so forth that's coming out of them is breaking this apart, okay? So now when you remember, we're talking about the Eastern Church, and you remember I pointed out, I think a couple of weeks ago maybe, that the Eastern Church is characterized by a focus on Greek philosophy. Remember, it's a Greek-speaking side of the empire. Remember, the Western side is Latin-speaking. This is the Greek side. You remember I pointed out that there was heavy Greek influence in that side of the church. I mean, today, the Greek Orthodox Church coming from that side is getting its philosophy and its philosophical concepts from Greece. Okay, so Greek philosophy became a part of the discussion, unfortunately. And it added a problem to all of this, in that this: Christian theologians had come to define God primarily in terms of his contrast to us as humans. That's a characteristic of Greek philosophy. The divine is utterly different from us. Okay? So the way to define God is to contrast him with us. That's Greek philosophy 101. You think of God in terms of what God is versus what we are not, or what we are, therefore God is not. And that was how it comes about. God is immutable because we change. God, therefore, must be one that does not change. God must be infinite because we are limited. God is omnipotent because we have only limited power. God is omnipresent because we can only be in one place at one time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, to define the divine is almost impossible from a human perspective, right? I mean, how do you define an infinite being? I mean, it's hard to do that, isn't it? It's hard to even grasp the idea of a being that has no beginning and no end, because all of us have a beginning and an end. Okay, so it's hard for us to understand the idea of an infinite God, and so what very often happened in philosophical circles and even in theological circles was to define God in terms of the human condition in reverse. Now, by the way, Paul does the exact opposite of that. Paul treats God as God with us being distinct from him. Okay? But Greek philosophy had taken over the eastern side of the empire, and so the Greek thinking theologians of the time would say, well, the best way that we can understand God and teach God to our children is to say, look, you have a beginning and an end, but God doesn't. And you can only be at one place at one time, but God can be everywhere, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So this adds to the problem. So the most prevalent error of the time was to declare that Jesus' two natures are not actually joined together in a single person. That the two natures have to be distinct, fully and completely and utterly, in every sense. Now, you'll understand what I mean by that in a second. Meaning, very often, that with this Greek philosophical effect or influence, this would force people to allow one nature to overcome the other in the person of Jesus. Okay, remember I said the Alexandrine position and the Antiochian position had a tendency to focus on one of those two natures to the exclusion of the other. And that's what Greek philosophy had a tendency to do. Everybody would take up their camp in terms of which part of the nature of Jesus they thought was most important. So you would decide, are you think the divinity of Jesus is more important because he must be God, or do you think of the humanity of Jesus more important because he must be one of us? Okay, pick a side. And that's what people were doing in that particular day. Again, let's just be fair now. Let's cut these people some slack. We're talking very early in the history of theological discussion. The debates have not yet taken place, of course, and we'll see how this fleshes out. And so the average Joe sitting in a church pew on a Sunday morning is trying to figure this out for himself. What's he going to do? He's going to be influenced by the world around him and by the people that are teaching him and how they're being influenced. And guess what? The result is going to be that people are going to have a tendency to go one way or the other. In fact, one of the ancient heresies of Docetism was the idea that Jesus' body was not in fact human at all, but an apparition, a vision, if you will, of a man, which simply satisfied the human senses. God entered into his world, and he looked like a man, and he seemed to be a man, but he really wasn't human. Okay, that particular error is what comes out of this way of thinking. Okay, I completely focus on the divinity of Jesus. He must be the God. He must be the God man. And so I'm going to focus on that part. And so the body of Jesus to me was just like a spirit thing that was just kind of there. You know, the disciples felt his presence, quote unquote, but he wasn't really human. In other words, in many ways, like a theophany of the Old Testament. Jesus was simply an appearance of God in some form, but he really wasn't physically there, okay? So there were a number of these kinds of views that came up about the nature of Jesus, depending upon where you came down on your view of the divinity or humanity of Christ. Which did you consider most important? Now, in the West, the church over there basically embraced or revived Tertullian's old formula, simply that Jesus was two natures in one person. A very simple understanding. Two natures in one person. And so the West really didn't attempt to reconcile this at all. It's just sort of sat there. People said, yep, he had two natures. What does that mean? I don't know, but I don't care. Okay? So when the debates begin to come up because of the Greek philosophical emphasis and influence, now you have to deal with the subject. Now when you ask the question, what does that actually mean? That produces an issue. And it's on the East that produces the issue, not so much on the West. The West just sort of said, well, we believe he's the God-man. Okay, what do you do about that? And that's why, by the way, as I said earlier, the West's influence on the East wasn't all that much, because the East had to bang this issue out. And the West had already sort of just assumed a conclusion, even though they haven't really done debate on it. So they didn't really have much influence because they weren't doing a lot of writing on the subject on the Western side of the empire. Now, there were a number of ways that this attempted to be resolved, okay? And I'm going to throw at you a lot of details here, so just kind of let them roll off. But we'll eventually get to a conclusion here, okay? Now, the first attempt to resolve the issue was by a man by the name of Apollinaris. He was actually, he lived prior to Constantinople in 381. He argued in his writings that Jesus had a human body but a divine soul. Okay, so imagine you have a physical human body, but the soul of the body, the immortal part of the body, is the divine nature. Okay? And so he attempted to resolve that as simply that the Word replaced the soul of the man. So there was a man who was without a soul, but the soul was God himself. Okay, now that seems to make some sense, because we talk about us as beings who are both mortal and immortal. We have a body, we have a soul, right? We have a part of us that's physical and corporeal, and then we have a part of us that's not, that's eternal. Okay, so Apollinaris says, well, if we just want to do this simply, Jesus was just a human body, a soulless human body, if you will, whose soul was actually God himself. Okay, now, the Antiochians, of course, insisted that Jesus must be fully human to save us. And so they rejected Apollinaris because they said to be fully human means you have a human soul. Okay? If you're going to be fully human, your fully human nature must be that you possess a body and a soul. You must possess the Imago Dei to be human. That cannot be just sent away. All right? So the first attempt wasn't really an attempt, but at least it was the first shot across the bow, if you will. But the second attempt to resolve the issue came from a man by the name of Nestorius. Nestorius was the bishop of Constantinople in 428. So you'll see we're in the 5th century. We're just a bit before the fall of the Western Empire here. He was the Patriarch of the East. You might call him the Pope of the East. That's anachronistic, but he was an Antiochian. So he believed in the position of the Antiochians, which is that Jesus had to be fully human, okay? The Alexandrians were looking for something to catch him with. Okay, again, politics plays much into these discussions, all right? So the Antiochians are just looking for him to make a mistake. He argued, then, that in Jesus were two natures and two persons. All right, we have to have two natures, so let's have two persons. There were two distinct persons in Jesus. Now, This will sound complicated, but try to bear with me here. Mary, he argued, Mary, the mother of Jesus, should not be referred to as Theotokos. Theotokos means mother of God. In fact, if you go into Greek churches, you will often hear her referred to as Theotokos. A Greek word meaning theos and takos meaning God, mother, mother of God. Okay, the idea being that she was the one who gave birth to the God-man. All right. He argued she shouldn't be considered the mother of God. The role of Mary is the human mother of the God-man. In this case, he argued that Mary should only be the mother of Christ, that she provided the human side of Jesus, where the Spirit provides the divine nature. So she's not the mother of God. She's the mother of a human being, one of the two persons, and the Spirit becomes the father, if you will, of the other person in Jesus, the divine person in him. Okay, so he argued for two distinct persons. So he argued one must distinguish in Jesus his two persons. Nestorianism, which lived beyond him, is the doctrine that Jesus was two distinct persons in a single body, a human person and a divine person, each unique from the other, and acting through the physical body of Jesus at different times and in different ways. So sometimes the human Jesus would act, like when eating a fish, or the divine Jesus would act when raising Lazarus from the dead. So it depended on which person took control of the physical body of Jesus at any particular moment in time. He had two different people in him at the same time. Now, Nestorianism, as I said, lasted for a while. Actually, it did. Now, it is a clear Antiochian position distinguishing the humanity of Jesus from his divinity, right? Because they are emphasizing there's a human person in there, okay? Now, Nestorius' enemies here, Alexandrians, saw the danger in this of dividing Jesus into an agreement rather than a joining, as though there's two people, persons, inside one physical body that are agreeing with each other, but they're not necessarily joined, they're distinct. Okay, so Jesus walking around was, in modern terms, what we called a man with multiple personality disorder, right? Okay, because he had one personality, which was Jesus, and the other personality, which was the Son of God. There was two distinct persons inside of him, and each one would take control of the eyes and ears and hands at different points. Okay, so they saw this as a danger. So the bishop of Alexandria, a man by the name of Cyril, opposed Nestorius, and he convinced the emperor to call a council at Ephesus in 431. A council at Ephesus in 431, this was officially the third ecumenical council. First at Nicaea, 325, the second at Constantinople in 381, and now here at Ephesus in 431, the third ecumenical council. The council came together and condemned Nestorius. He was not there, he was condemned in absentia, and they labeled him a heretic. But a man by the name of John of Antioch, look where he comes from, Antioch, okay, this would be the very place that this idea of the humanity of Jesus is being emphasized. He comes a few days later, and he called a rival council. Okay, fine, you can have your council, I'll make my own. And so they called a rival council, and they declared Cyril, this bishop, a heretic. So Emperor Theodosius II gets involved at this point, because there comes a point when an emperor's got to get involved, right? So the emperor comes along. He has both men arrested. He declared John's council invalid. He exiled Nestorius, first to a monastery in Antioch and then off to Petra, and declared that Nestorius' view of Jesus was heretical. Okay, so you'll notice in this case an emperor comes in and makes a choice. But what he's really doing, in essence, is he's validating the conclusion of the council that was called. So the council's called, they declare Nestorius to be a heretic, his view to be heretical. Another rival council comes along, which tries to declare something obvious. The emperor says, wait a minute, forget it. He arrests the two men, sends Nestorius away. I don't know what happened to John of Antioch, but he sends Nestorius away and says, look, the original council, the third ecumenical council at Ephesus, is the right one. Nestorius is wrong. Now, you will notice this doesn't actually answer a question. All this does is say this guy's view is wrong. Okay? So we're not done yet. We haven't declared anything at this point. All right? So we need to move along, which comes to a man by the name of Eutychus. Now, Eutychus is living at about the same time as Nestorius. He was a monk in Constantinople. He was a man who is referred to as without theological subtlety. In other words, he was a man who took a sledgehammer to theology. He declared that Jesus was of one substance with the Father, but not of one with us. In other words, he had two natures before the union of the two, but then only one nature after the union. So he became, his view was, if you will, opposite of Nestorius's, and that Nestorius says, in Jesus there's two distinct persons, body and soul. But my position is that the divine and the human come, this is Eutychus' position, the divine and the human come together in the womb of Mary, and what pops out of Mary as a child is a single person with a single nature. A one-natured being, okay? It's a mixture of the divine and the human, all right? So you'll notice how it's exactly the opposite of Nestorius' view. Now, Patriarch Flavian accused him of docetism and condemned him, said, your view makes it look as though Jesus is only an apparition. I mean, where's the real Jesus in all of that? Because what would be the obvious conclusion? If you combine the divine nature with the human nature, what happens to the human nature? It's pretty much gone, isn't it? Because when you combine the infinite with the finite, the infinite is going to win. So Flavian said, you're just a docetist in different clothing. All right, so he had him expelled and condemned. But the Patriarch of Alexandria, a man by the name of Dioscorus, maneuvered the conflict until Theodosius II, we saw him earlier, called another council at Ephesus, this one, in 449. Now, this council was a political council only. You'll notice I didn't call it the Fourth Ecumenical Council. It's not. This particular council at 449 appeared to be rigged because the emperor was appointed to be the president, of the assembly. Okay, so you got an emperor now who's supposedly leading a theological council. Really? The council appeared to be rigged. Now, there was a letter that was sent by Pope Leo from the West, called Leo's Tome, which was rejected. And this Flavian fellow, the patriarch, was manhandled violently in this council. It broke out in violence. And he was manhandled so much that he died a few days later after it. The council declared that the idea of two natures in Christ was heretical. Now, that's important. The council declared that the idea of two distinct natures in Christ was heretical. They were taking the position of Eutychus that there was a single nature in Jesus only. So they declared this idea of two natures to be heretical. Pope Leo labeled the council as the robber synod. Robber, R-O-B-B-E-R, robber synod. Because he thought it was invalid. It didn't make any sense. And it stuck, by the way. That title stuck to this council from this point. This council was never embraced as an official council of the ecumenical church. Its conclusions were rejected by the Orthodox Church over time. It's almost as though this political council was called in order for the emperor to finally get some settlement on this issue. He rigged the whole thing. It blew up in his face. The patriarch was killed in the process, and it turned into a mess. And the West, the Pope from the West, Pope Leo, just said, that's a worthless synod. What's the point of it? So it was never embraced, even by the East, as an ecumenical council. Which leads us, however, to the Council of Chalcedon in 451. Theodosius, the emperor, was riding a horse one day. It stumbled through him and he died. Killed him. His sister, a woman by the name of Pucheria, who was a modern Alexandrian, then called for a new council. Now, she felt that the robber council of 449 left much to be desired. Duh. So she called the council at the behest of Pope Leo, who had considered it the robber council. She called. Not by phone, but you know, she got a hold of him and said, would you launch a new ecumenical council at Chalcedon where we could deal with this issue? Now, at first, the council condemned both Dioscorus and Eutychus for their positions and forgave the others at the robber synod. Basically, just said, okay, let's put that behind us, all right? Then they read and affirmed Leo's original tome that he had sent to the robber synod. You remember, it was rejected. His position in regards to this subject. They had read it and they agreed that it was correct. It was a reaffirmation of Tertullian's view. Remember I said earlier that the West had pretty much just accepted Tertullian's view that in Christ was one person with two distinct natures. Again, they didn't flesh it out very much, but now at Chalcedon, Pope Leo defends that position because it's the position of the West, and so the Council of Chalcedon embraces this idea that Jesus is, in fact, a man who possesses two distinct natures, one human and one divine. They are not one nature that have been melded together or melted together to become one, but two distinct natures. So they produced at Chalcedon a definition of faith. Now again, it's not a creed, but it's a definition of faith that reaffirms the previous councils on this issue. And it goes like this, quote, "This is one and the same Christ, Son, Lord, only begotten." All right, now that's all Nicaea language there. Okay, let's reaffirm that Jesus is fully God in every sense, that the Son of God is fully God. He is not a divine creature, but he is the full divine nature of Yahweh. "This is the one and same Christ, Son, Lord, only begotten, manifested in two natures without any confusion, change, division, or separation." Meaning that these are two natures that coexist in Jesus as unique from each other, not in any way altering the other, meaning that the divine does not overcome the human, or the human does not overcome the divine. They stand within Jesus as peers to one another. They are distinct, and yet at the same time, infinitely close to one another. They're not one nature that they have been subsumed into one, but they're two distinct natures that are infinitely close to one another. Okay? This union does not destroy the difference of the two natures, but on the contrary, the properties of each are kept, and both are joined in one person and hypostasis, or method of coming together. Okay? They are not divided into two persons, but belong to the one only begotten Son, the Word of God, the Lord Jesus Christ. Okay? That's Chalcedonian language for the idea that Jesus is fully the God-man. He possesses a full nature as a human being. He received from his mother all of the attributes of humanity, all of what it means to be human, including in us the image of God as creatures, right? We are created in the image of God. We possess abilities as human beings that come out of the image of God, right? The ability to think, the ability to speak, the ability to rationally make moral decisions, and the list goes on and on, right? Okay. He possesses a human nature, but he also possesses a divine nature. And in the divine nature, all of the attributes of God are present. Nothing in the divine nature has been left behind. Okay? In fact, there's one of those songs that we sing that we really need to change the lyrics to, and I forget the title, but it's "Emptying Himself of All But Love," right? I forget the song, but in the song it says, "Emptying Himself of All But Love." No. And can it be? Yeah. No. He did not empty himself of all but love. He kept in himself the fullness of his nature as a human being, so that he possessed all of the foibles and limitations of humanness, as well as possessing a nature in which he has all of the nature of the divine. Or as my friend Dr. Kimbrell points it out, the helpless baby lying in the manger is holding together the manger under him as God. Just as the Son of God would hold together all the universe, he's holding together the very manger under him. Okay? And yet he's a helpless baby in that cradle, that thing at the same time. Okay? So Chalcedonian language, this language I just read to you, has become definitive for the church as the orthodox view of who Christ is. The Chalcedonian Declaration is mirrored in both the Westminster Confession and 1689 Confessions. If you go read the view of Christ, you will see this language almost exactly in both of those confessions. It does not define the union. Okay? In other words, you cannot define this union. There's no way for us in our limited human abilities under the scientific method to define exactly how a complete human and a complete Yahweh can coexist in one individual without one of those two natures subsuming the other, no confusion between them, both acting simultaneously in the person. I don't know, and I don't think, frankly, any of us will ever know how that works. I mean, it will take us an eternity of spending our time with Jesus, asking him questions, and we will continue to get the answers, but as humans, we will do exactly what was being done in the Eastern Church. We will run to one corner or the other. Oh, so you were God at this point. Well, I was human there too. Oh, but you were human here. Oh, but I was God here too. Okay? It will be hard. It's impossible for us to get. So Chalcedon doesn't attempt to define the union, but it sets the boundary of error. In other words, you can't say that Jesus was just a man, or that his divine nature was limited, or that God chose to give up certain of his attributes in order to become a man. By the way, that particular view that I just mentioned there is very popular amongst Baptists. That in fact, the Jesus that was walking around in Palestine in the first century was mostly human. Had a little divinity in him, but mostly human. And then when he ascended back to heaven, he became mostly divine, with just a little bit of humanity. In fact, you ask the average Baptist, is Jesus human in heaven now? And their answer will be, no. They are pseudo-docetists. Most Baptists have become pseudo-docetists on this issue. Chalcedon says the Jesus that we know from Scripture was fully human in every sense of that word and fully divine in every sense of that word, simultaneously with two distinct natures, neither one subsuming the other, confusing the two natures together. Okay? That's Chalcedonian language. By the way, just as an aside, it is reasonable that the dissenters to Chalcedonian Orthodoxy who settled in Persia and Arabia had an indirect effect upon Muhammad. Okay, so we'll talk about Muhammad a little bit later. Now, this definition is clearly extra-biblical. There's nowhere in the Bible that you can find this definition, right? Just like you won't find the definition of Trinity anywhere in the Bible either. Okay, so in other words, this is one of those things that when you look at it, you have to look with peripheral vision into Scripture to see it. But it's clearly visible. Jesus himself speaks in ways at times where it's obvious that he's speaking as a divine person, yet he's standing there in a human body. Okay, so we need to keep that tension in mind as we consider this. All right, so Chalcedon, which is the fourth ecumenical council, is the one that becomes, if you will, the one of the premier councils. Nicaea and Chalcedon are considered the two most important of the ecumenical councils when it comes to the issues of the nature of God or the nature of the Son of God. Nicaea dealing with the issue of the Son of God, Chalcedon dealing with the issue of the nature of Jesus. So if someone comes to you and talks to you about Nicaean Orthodoxy, they're talking about the issue of the Trinity. If somebody comes to talk to you about Chalcedonian Orthodoxy, they're talking about the nature of Jesus. Okay? Now, there were differences that obviously continued. Differences remained between the Orthodox and a group called the Monophysites. Mono, of course, meaning one. The Monophysites were those who claimed Jesus had only one nature, meaning there was a mixture of the human and divine in him. You see that traveling back to Eutychus above and Nestorius above in a sense as well, in the sense that there were still some who for a very long time couldn't deal with this idea of Jesus being both human and divine simultaneously, and so they were forced into a position of declaring themselves to be what we call Monophysites. Emperor Justinian, you remember, Emperor Justinian was the most significant emperor of the Eastern Empire during the 6th century. Remember, the Eastern Empire rose to its greatest power under Justinian. He called a council at Constantinople in 553, which we call the Fifth Ecumenical Council. And the purpose of this council was to calm this Monophysite objection to Chalcedon. It had little effect, and it's been mostly forgotten. Nobody really talks about it. The Arab conquests of the 7th and 8th centuries that we're going to talk about next week, Lord willing, put an end to much of the discussion relating to the nature of Jesus. Chalcedon had declared what was considered orthodox, and a lot of the other little minor skirmishes that broke out after that got subsumed under the Arabs and what they were doing with the rise of Islam. So Constantinople no longer felt the need to try to reconcile them. There was another council at Constantinople in 680 and 81, which was the sixth ecumenical council. It ended the debate permanently. Pope Honorius, who had become a monotheist, don't ask me to explain what that is, he was declared a heretic. And the declaration that a pope could be declared a heretic by a council was problematic in the Catholic Church in the 19th century when the Church attempted to declare that the Pope can speak infallibly. How can an infallible Pope be considered a heretic? Right? So, the issue of the nature of Jesus is debated through most of the 6th, 5th, and 6th centuries, from about the fall of Rome through the rest of the 5th century to about 600 and then even beyond, even to the latter part of the 7th century, you see this debate continuing on. But by the time you get to Chalcedon, in 451, the issue's pretty much been decided. So true Orthodox Christianity, which, by the way, was re-embraced by the Reformers in the days of the Reformation, establishes two fundamental truths flowing from Nicaea and Chalcedon. One, that the Son of God is fully God in every sense. He is not a created being. He is a part of the Trinity, eternally equal to the Father and yet begotten of the Father. And secondly, that Jesus was fully God and fully man, possessing all of the nature of humanity and all the nature of divinity simultaneously. Those two realities, as much paradox and tension as they produce in our minds, is in fact Orthodox Christianity. Now, the unfortunate reality is that in the 21st century, Nicene Orthodoxy and Chalcedonian Orthodoxy have really taken a hit. Evangelicals, I bet you couldn't find a handful of evangelicals that can properly define for you the Trinity. And to try to have a conversation with the nature of Jesus amongst a typical evangelical in terms of his nature as divine and human, you will find them probably being declared a heretic by Chalcedon in one way or another. And I think the reason for that, frankly, if I might be so bold, is that the church failed to teach it, or has failed to teach it for a long time. We just assume it, right? We just assume that a person walking into a Baptist church who makes a profession of faith inherently knows that Jesus is fully God and fully man, and that the Son of God is fully God in every sense. We just assume it. Why would we do that? Because we have centuries of people who did not, and centuries of people who had to debate it in order to actually get to the place where they declared what was revealed biblically. So I think our problem is that we make assumptions that people know these things when they don't. So those of us who embrace Nicene Orthodoxy and Chalcedonian Orthodoxy, because we embrace the confessions that are based upon them, we have a tendency to preach those things. So you will notice that I have a tendency to hammer the issue of Trinitarianism and the nature of Jesus, because I want to make sure you get it. You may not be able to explain it, but at least you get it, so that you can truly not be a heretic. Now, there's another conflict or debate that comes up, and I'm going to go fairly quickly through this. The notes that you have will be more complex than I'm going to actually talk about, but it's something called the iconoclastic debate. This pops up during this particular period of time as well. Doesn't really affect us as Baptists too terribly much, because we are not iconoclasts, okay? So we don't have images in our churches, okay? The iconoclastic debate was the final Christological debate that occurred during the 8th and 9th centuries. So we're moving way past even the Islam, but it fits into the Christological world. An icon is a picture or image that represents something sacred, okay, by resembling it. So a stained glass window with a picture of Jesus in it is an icon, or a statue of Mary is an icon, or an object hammered out of gold that's flat but yet has an image in it is an icon, or a bit of a bone that comes from a saint, apparently, is an icon. In other words, something that represents something sacred by resemblance or analogy to it. The early church didn't seem to have much trouble with icons, because there are many of them carved into the walls of the catacombs. Okay, so the early church probably didn't have a problem with this. But with the dawn of the imperial church, many of the bishops preached against icons because they were concerned about the masses of people flocking to them. What happens when you have a whole world full of people who suddenly call themselves Christians? What are they going to do? Human beings are idol factories, are we not? We are idol factories. That's why we have to have commandments right at the very beginning of the Decalogue, which tell us don't make any idols and worship them, okay? Because that's what we do. As Paul says in Romans 1, we have a tendency to make idols and worship them. Creatures and images and animals and so forth, and bow down to them. We're golden calf makers, is what we do. We throw this gold into the fire and out comes this calf, right? Okay, so in the imperial church, with this massive influx of Christians, the bishops began to preach against that idea. So the idea of getting rid of icons and getting rid of images began to take hold. And some Byzantine emperors in the 8th century either destroyed or forbade the use of images. Now, this may have been a response to Chalcedon. Again, this is why I'm calling it a Christological debate. Because, listen, if you have Jesus fully a man, and at the same time, he possesses the fullness of God in himself, how do you represent that in an image? How do you represent that in a picture? If you draw a picture of the man, what have you drawn a picture of? You've only drawn a picture of the man side of the equation, because you can't draw a picture of the divine side of the equation. So when you see the typical Methodist Caucasian Jesus with the, you know, beard that comes down to a point, right, and looks like a Caucasian, you see it hanging in every Methodist church in the world, that is an icon of the human side of the equation. So many of these Byzantine emperors said, we don't want to represent Jesus that way, because we don't want people thinking about Jesus in terms of his human side only, because that's what's naturally going to happen. And also to curb the power of the monks, who apparently were strong supporters of icons during this particular time. We'll also see that Islam forbade the use of images very specifically, and that may also have been a reaction by the Eastern side. So there were factions that took up sides in this debate. The iconoclasts were those who were, on the one side, destroyers of images, who saw them as idols. I said a minute ago that we are not iconoclasts. I was incorrect. We are iconoclasts. We believe that images are not appropriate in the worship life of the church. Okay, Baptists have been clear iconoclasts for a long time. But there are the iconodules who believe that images can, in fact, be worshipped. Jesus, I mean, their argument goes like this. Hey, Jesus was a representation of God on earth, so why can't we make a representation of Jesus on earth? God himself was the first maker of images, right? I mean, we call it the Imago Dei, so why can't we make images too? And since God represents himself in nature, why can't we use icons as commentaries for this as well? Well, this debate went on for a while until we come to the Council of Nicaea in 787. This is the seventh ecumenical council. The council at Nicaea, it's confusing because it's at Nicaea, right? Okay, but that's not what we mean when we talk about Nicene Orthodoxy. This has nothing to do with the Trinity. This has only to do with images. The council at Nicaea attempted to distinguish between latria and dulia. Any of you who've listened to James White at some point in the past have probably heard these terms, because when he debates Roman Catholics, he deals with the issue of latria and dulia. Latria is a Greek word meaning to worship. Dulia is a word meaning to venerate, or to give something special honor, but not to treat it as an object of worship. Okay? Latria is to worship something, specifically to worship God. Dulia is the idea of looking at an object, seeing its value as something representing something else, not worshiping the object itself, but worshiping what it represents. Okay? So they attempted to distinguish between the two. So what the East did, and you will notice that Eastern Orthodox churches of every kind are covered in icons. If you've ever been to an Orthodox church, you will see there's massive amounts of icons in the church, okay? Because at this particular point at Nicaea, images were officially restored in 842. Coming out of this view, the East said, listen, we can distinguish between dulia and latria, and we will teach our people to distinguish between dulia and latria. Don't worship the object. Venerate the object as valuable, but worship what it represents. Okay? We can do that. Problem is, the two terms, latria and dulia, are difficult to translate into Latin on the West. Okay? It's hard to do that. And so, in the West, the use of images at first was not well received. But what happened over time was, because there was no distinction, because the distinction between latria and dulia could not be brought into the Latin language that easily, the average person couldn't distinguish between the two. And so the average person says, well, we can have images, right? As long as we don't worship them, if we just can venerate them. And so the West eventually capitulated. And if you go into a Catholic church, you will notice that it's full of images of every kind, because they settled this idea of making a distinction between latria and dulia. The issue would appear again at the Reformation, although it would vary amongst the reformers. Some of the reformers were much more iconoclastic. Some were much more kind of dualist, believing that you can embrace images. So it depends on who you ask. Not everybody agreed on this. It was difficult. But the Baptists believed that it was necessary to reject the use of images in order to not violate the commandments of God, not to worship objects. And the primary logic behind the Baptist position is exactly the conversation we were having earlier. And that is, if you're going to be reformed. And the position was this. If an ordinary Joe can't tell the difference between worshiping an object and venerating an object, then maybe we ought not to have the object at all. In other words, if a woman standing before a statue of Mary can't distinguish between worshiping the statue and worshiping the Mary behind her, which is forbidden, then we should, as Baptists, go, let's just get rid of the images entirely. We don't have the issue at all then. In other words, let's go and be reformed. Let's get rid of the issue entirely because it just produces confusion, which is precisely the point. When you go to a Catholic today and debate a Catholic on the issue of images in the church and their veneration of those images, I can guarantee you that the typical Catholic has no idea of the difference between dulia and latria. No idea of the difference between taking a look at a statue and seeing it as an image representing something else and thus worshiping the something else, or just kneeling before the statue. They can't make that distinction. Most human beings can't. Because again, what are we? Idol factories. It's what we do. And so you debate a Catholic, you find yourself in a position of having to try to explain the difference between dulia and latria. They haven't got a clue. And that's why they will easily bow down to images, which we would consider idolatry, right? They would not, but they do. Okay, so that's another Christological discussion. Notice how it flows out of the image of Jesus, the human Jesus. What do we do about an image of him? Okay, so that becomes the last Christological debate and the seventh ecumenical council. Now, we're going to see from this point then, as we kind of get to the end of these Christological discussions, we're going to see the East and the West now dividing from each other rather significantly. We're going to now see real separation between them. Obviously, there's going to be based on cultural differences. We've got Greek speaking on one side, we've got Latin speaking on the other. That's a real problem. Like I said, the Latria Dulia thing was an issue in trying to translate one language into another and people trying to understand the concept. We also, of course, have the demise of the Western Empire and the church filling that vacuum with the rise of the popes taking political power over the people. And that's so very different from what you have in the East, where the emperors are still taking power over the people and the bishops are still just doing their thing of leading worship and teaching people what it means to be a believer. That becomes a significant difference, especially when the popes in the West try to exercise influence over the people in the East. From a political perspective, not a Christological, a theological perspective, but a political perspective. We also see this continuing control of the Eastern Church by its emperors, with the emperors using their political clout to force some theological issues, as I pointed out. There was one particular emperor who stuck his nose right in the middle of the Christological issue in order to try to get a resolution. Yet the church during the early medieval period still considered itself one church, okay? And we will continue to see the Western and Eastern church as a single church, although slowly drifting apart until you get to the official schism of those two churches in 1054. So we will go about 1,000 years from the ascension of Christ with a single church, roughly. It'll be divided into two sides of the world, with one side being more political than theological and the other side being more theological than political. We'll see that. But it will still consider itself one church, worshiping one God and one Christ and having a pretty much a singular confession across the totality of it. I think you could walk into any typical Eastern church in the 8th century or 9th century, for example, and you would find similar worship that you would find in the Western church at the same time. Not today, because once you get to the Great Schism, what happens is the Eastern Church sort of stays put where it's at, and the Western Church just goes boing. Okay? We're going to see some of that as we go along. Okay. So that's the Christological debate that finishes up, if you will, the theological realities of this period of time. And so now I hope you understand, you can kind of get a feel. There's much more that could have been said here, of course. But you kind of get a feel of where these theological issues came from, where they started from. Okay, so we dealt with Nicaea and the issue of God, and now you see the church having to be forced to dealing with the nature of Jesus because men are asking questions and they're going into different camps of heresy and there's no real consensus. But by the time you get to Chalcedon in the middle part of the 5th century, you wind up with you wind up with a consensus. And by the way, in case you didn't notice it, Chalcedon is in 451, which puts it prior to the fall of the Roman Empire, the Western Roman Empire. Okay, so really, by the time you finish the barbarian sweeps in to throw over Rome, you pretty much have Trinitarian and Christological theology nailed. But there's one more area that will become a problem. And that, of course, is we must move from the Trinity to the Christ, and then, of course, to... Anybody want to take a guess? No. He's never really a problem. Salvation itself. Okay, so we're going to have to move into the discussions eventually of the whole issue of justification. And guess when that comes up? In the days of the Reformation. It will take another 1,000 years to get there, but that will be the next great theological debate that will arise. Okay? So when we talk about the ecumenical councils, we talk about the 7 great ecumenical councils that took place in the East, and particularly deciding the issue of Trinitarian and Christological issues. Questions? Not really, no. Just pressure, I think. Well, that's, okay, when you say churches not allow.
Well, I mean like saying I can't have any, there will be no pictures of Jesus in children's programs.
Oh, well, okay, yeah, all right, I see where you're going. I get your point, okay. What we're distinguishing in this iconoclastic debate is the issue of worship in terms of images being used for worship. If you place images into the room that you do worship in, what happens with those images, right? They become a part of the function of worship. And it becomes, yeah, it can be. I mean, if you've got stained glass windows with images of various aspects of Jesus' life, it sends a message, doesn't it, that we in this room, we worship, and those give us something to help us worship. And as I said, the average Joe has a difficulty figuring out how to distinguish that as just something that is helpful versus something that becomes part of worship. Now, I realize that some will take that to the nth degree, which is, well, then we can have no images at all on paper of any kind related to images, like in Sunday school classes and curricula and things like that and so forth. Okay. But we're not really worshiping in those environments. Those are more of teaching environments, and so images can be useful to help us to understand. You know, a picture Bible can be helpful for a young child to help understand, if he can't read, for example, help understand some of the things that are contained in Scripture. Okay, so Baptists wouldn't preclude that. I mean, some hyper iconoclast would. But I think your typical Baptist said, that's fine. We just want to be very careful that we don't put images within the framework of worship. Yes. Michelangelo. We're talking Reformation now. Okay, so you're moving way ahead in time. See, yeah, we're still way ahead. By this time, the Catholic Church had pretty much given in to the iconodules and embraced images. Took longer than it did in the East. but it was there. So when Michelangelo painted the Sistine Chapel, he didn't have a problem at all putting a picture of God and Adam on the ceiling, because he would have been part of a church that at that particular point, 1,000 years after this debate took place, that had already given in to this issue long ago. The iconoclasm debates were 8th and 9th centuries. Michelangelo's in, what, the 16th century? 1500s? So the church, the Western church and the Eastern church, are both filled with images. Now, there's some significant differences, however, in the images. In the Eastern churches, you will not find images of Mary, because Marian dogma did not take hold in the East. That was a Western invention. So you won't find images of Mary, but you will find images of saints. But they're not treated in the same way as the image of a saint in the Western church, because in the Western church, a saint is considered to be a super Christian whose righteousness so exceeded his own need that he was able to give his righteousness to others. That thinking is not present at all in Eastern theology. Okay, so you can walk into an Eastern Orthodox church. The images, when you go there, they will feel different, because they are. They're focused in a different way of the theology of the Eastern church as compared to the theology of the Western church. There's no problem with a big statue of Mary in the middle of a Catholic church. None at all. In fact, there are some places where that image is front and center. And you will also notice that in a Catholic church, a Western church, there are images of Jesus himself on every cross. Crucifixes are still very much a part of the picture, because they consider, now again, that flows out of their theology, the sacrifice of Christ is not complete in the Catholic church. You need to represent his sacrifice on the altar every time you go to Mass. And so Christ has never come off that cross. And so that's why he's on every cross, because it flows out of the theology. That wouldn't be the case on the Eastern side, because that did not develop on the Eastern side. Now, let me be clear. Justification by faith alone has been lost on the Eastern side as well, but for different reasons and in a different perspective. They just didn't have a Protestant Reformation on that side. God didn't raise up a Luther on that side to deal with the issue. But he did in the West.
So if you went to the Greek Orthodox churches here in
Yep.
There's no Christ on the cross.
You won't see Christ on the cross. Nope. If you do, I'd be surprised. That would be a strange thing for it to be there. And I'd want to question the patriarch as to why that is, because it wouldn't fit his understanding. You will mostly see images of saints. And very often, some of the oldest saints, some of the men we've even talked about here, will have images of them. Mm-hmm.
When you're saying saints, you're not talking about the apostles. You're talking about
people. No. Well, other people, but the apostles as well.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I saw in the Greek Orthodox church that I went to in Minneapolis, I think that there was the ring of 12 apostles was on the ceiling, if I'm not mistaken. Of course. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, many of them we've talked about. Athanasius, Augustine, the list goes on and on. Of men who probably go, why is my face on the wall? It's not about me. Mm-hmm. Any other questions you had? No? Okay. Any other questions at all? Yeah. It does. I'm not exactly sure how it grew up. It obviously grew up out of Marian dogmatism, because it's connected to it's the rosary, which is connected to the prayers to Mary. So I'm not exactly sure the beginnings of the rosary beads, I'm not exactly sure.
What's their intention with the beads? Like, what are they supposed to do? Because you always see it,
The beads are just as, it's exactly what you just keep you on track.
Help you remember
where you're at. You have to pray so many of them, and so you lose track after a while. So it's best to have like some sort of thing that you can have in your hand that you can move to the next one. And then every 10 Hail Marys, you have to pray in Our Father. So that one's a little slightly different bead, and then you move on and so on. So I'll never forget when I got my first rosary as a kid. I said, I'll never forget when I got my first rosary as a kid. I earned it. I did. I was earning the wrath of God at the same time.
But when the Catholics go in powerful, they take their seat.
Yep.
Come to kneel.
Yep.
Even slightly. They bow to the mirror.
No, they're actually bowing to the consecrated host at the front of the church. Remember, this is off the subject, but I'll try to make this very, very quickly. When the priest consecrates the bread and the wine, he turns it into, according to Catholic theology, into the actual body and blood of Christ. Well, you can't just discard that. I mean, if you don't have enough people to actually consume what you consecrated, then it has to be kept for a future mass to be used again. And so typically at the front of a Catholic church, you will find a tabernacle. Interesting word for it. They call it a tabernacle. And they will place, the priest will place into that box whatever he has left over in the Mass when the Mass is complete. And there's always a light shining next to it, usually a candle that's lit there. So when the typical Catholic comes in and he blesses himself with the holy water and he genuflects, he is admitting or basically worshiping the fact that Christ is in that box up there. Because he is, in their thinking. He's physically present in the body and blood that's in the box, in the tabernacle at the front. So that has nothing to do with icons, okay? But that seriously has to do with the doctrine of justification by faith. Yeah. Are you an ex-Catholic?
I am.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes,
oh, how did I not know that?
You didn't ask.
Well, I'm going to go walk around and go, are you ex-Catholic? You know.
Real proud of
I know that. But
because I wasn't even a very good one of
that. Well, none of us were.
CEO.
Well, none of us were. Yeah, right.
CEO,
right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so. So you understand all this stuff. You could have taught that. Most Catholics, however, you know, don't really understand the ramifications of what they're doing when they genuflect before a box full of the, you know, body and blood of Christ. They don't really understand what it is they're doing. I mean, that's a pretty significant form of idolatry, if you want my opinion. No. Well, they are. He's in the box. No. They're bowing before the tabernacle. They're bowing before the tabernacle. It's in the tabernacle. Yeah. That's his official name. I call it the box. See, we as... And that candle has to be kept in perpetual light. That tabernacle always has to be in the light. It can't be in the dark. I suppose in theory, but that rarely happens. So, and you know what? I suspect they won't let that happen, to be honest with you. I bet they would consecrate more than they need always in order to keep him in the tabernacle at all times, because his eternal presence is the point, right? I mean, he's present. So I would suspect that the answer to your question would be they would never allow that. So you actually have to have some way to replace that candle that's burning in there. All the time. And I remember the priest at the church that I went to would have to go out there every day and check that candle. They had very slow burning candles that, you know, big candles with slow burning wicks, and so it would take a long time for it to go down. But he would have to go in there every day and make sure that candle was still lit. And in many ways, you remember, think about the symbolism here. Catholicism is an Old Testament religion. And remember, in the tabernacle, there was the lampstand that had to be kept lit all the time in front of the mercy seat. Remember? And so all of the imagery in Catholicism is right out of the Old Testament. and the showbread. I mean, we're taking the body of Christ and putting it in there, but and the mercy seat and the altar and all the list goes on and on. It's all Old Testament. I mean, even the guy standing there is a priest. They use it in the next Mass. Yeah, he'll take it out at the beginning of the Mass, whatever's left. He'll consecrate a new host and some new wine, and then they'll serve the congregation, and then he'll put back in what's ever left over. So it's just a constant recycling of it. Yeah. Well, they must have some sort of dedication procedure, you know, where the priest comes in and blesses the tabernacle, and then they light the candle, and then they put the first host and wine in there, the first leftovers in there. Yeah, 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 yeah. No, they would probably have some sort of consecration service and so forth to set aside, you know. Again, Old Testament stuff. So. Go to the women's room. It's like, I'm out of here. Well, the toilets are easier to use in there. Huh? Yes. Yes. Right. You bet. Its content's irrelevant, but the book is important. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No. Oh, no, no. It was carried special. It had a special place. In many ways, it was like the old, what did they call it? The phylactery in the synagogue where they would keep the Torah scrolls? Same idea? So, look, if you haven't figured it out by now, human beings are easily converted into little idol-worshipping heretics.
Yeah.
Doesn't take much effort to do that. But when you give a church 1,000 years... from these iconoclastic debates to today, to not only get to a point where they start embracing actual images, but then their theology, their salvation, their soteriology goes so far away from justification by faith alone, and they abandon sola scriptura, which they did long, long ago. The net effect of that is, well, the sky's the limit in terms of what we will create and what we will invent and how it looks. And you know, the Catholic Catechism is a stack of books this big because it's 1,500 years worth of stuff that they have invented over time. No individual Catholic can understand any of it, or all of it. We can understand some of it, but not all of it, especially if you're not really connected to the church that much, if you're just sort of your, you know, typical Christmas and Easter kind of Catholic. So, and the other thing is the church, for a long, long time, kept its people in the dark on purpose about what it was believing.
Didn't even let them have a Bible.
Right. You couldn't read the Bible. It was in Latin. Most people couldn't read Latin. By the time you get to the 9th, 10th centuries, Latin is a dead language, and most people haven't got a clue how to read it anymore. So you got a Bible in Latin, but only the priest can read it, and the priest ain't in the business of telling you how to live your life in holiness. He's in the business of you coming to the church and doing what he tells you to do so that you pay your tithe and he gets his money and everybody, you know. Now, again, Old Testament sacrificial system, right? It's very familiar today, yes, absolutely. So, look, this is what happens to human beings. We don't stay orthodox. We will fall back away. Look, we had a Reformation in the 1500s and 1600s, right? Where are we today?
Look where Germany is today.
Look where the Lutheran Church is today, or any of the mainline denominations. The vast majority of Baptists, the vast majority of Protestants in general, evangelicals in general. Is there orthodoxy? I mean, James Wright wrote a book called The Forgotten Trinity 10 years ago to try to help typical evangelicals to understand the Trinity, because he argues in the beginning of the book that the vast majority of evangelicals are heretics when it comes to the Trinity. They don't believe the Trinity as it was defined in Nicaea. And certainly don't believe about the nature of Jesus as it was defined at Chalcedon. So it's not unusual to see what we see today. But now I hope you're getting a feel for where these things are starting and why they get to where we're at, which is always, of course, the way to prevent it from happening in the future. Know where you started and go back. Know your history. All right, thanks for coming out tonight. Those of you who are joined by Zoom, thank you for coming out as well. And next week we'll talk about the rise of Islam.